Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
And good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us here on Tactics in the Situation Room, where speech isn't violence, tolerance isn't love, and disagreement isn't hate. So welcome to the program for everybody that's joining us through YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Periscope. Unfortunately, I'm not sure whether or not I'm on Mixer. Without getting into too much detail, Microsoft has been a royal pain in the butt, as they almost always are the past few minutes, or the past few days, actually. And so I'm trying to work out all the kinks there, but we're getting there. If we're not broadcasting on Mixer right now, it's kind of unclear whether that's working right now or not, but, you know, you can always go to one of my, I don't know, 7 other different venues. So it's not like you don't have options when it comes to watching Tactics here every day at 6 p.m. So what's going on right now in the state of Alabama is this Senate race has really gone nuts. I mean, you've got the whole thing with Tuberville and Senator Jones. And what's interesting here is that it looks like Tuberville really has, and we all know that every other word out of his mouth is a praise of Donald Trump, so I think that when it comes to that, it should come as no surprise, but Tommy Tuberville has basically been, he's kind of shifted strategies the past few days, at least based on what I've seen, and he is essentially running against Doug Jones, which is a fascinating strategy because it's interesting just because he's not running against Doug Jones, at least not yet. So it's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off. It looks like he is taking a playbook out of his hero, Trump, his playbook, which, I mean, honestly, is probably not a terrible strategy at this point. You remember that back in the Republican primary that what happened is that President Donald Trump decided, when he was candidate Trump, and actually before he was even Republican candidate Trump, when he was trying to secure the Republican nomination, his strategy was to, of course, go after and sort of carpet bomb his opponents, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, whoever else that may include. He went after just about everybody, including Ben Carson. But one of the things that he did that was really interesting, and it's a strategy that obviously worked in his favor, is he spent as much, if not more, time going after Hillary Clinton because she was the projected candidate at the time. And he just spent a ton of time talking about her and how terrible she was, and that eventually did launch him to the nomination and eventually the presidency. And so it appears as though what's going on here is that Tommy Tuberville has launched a similar strategy because he's definitely been going after other people on the campaign trail, first and foremost Jeff Sessions, more than anybody else. But it's interesting that he's seen a real shift in the past couple weeks. We've seen him really talking more about how horrible Senator Doug Jones is, and I mean, most, I would say 90% of what he's saying is accurate and fair. But it's just fascinating, too, to look and see that his strategy has shifted to essentially, I'm just going to start attacking Doug Jones, and maybe that'll put the perception, I guess, in people's minds that I'm already the one running against it. Now, I don't know if that strategy is going to work for him or not, but looking at his recent poll numbers, I mean, it looks like it's going to be him or Jeff Sessions, at least if the vote were taken today. So maybe it's a winning strategy. Instead of spending all his time lambasting his opponents, he starts lambasting Doug Jones and basically starts acting like he already is the Republican candidate for the Senate seat that is opening up for the state of Alabama. So we'll see if it's an effective strategy or not. And speaking of elections that have national implications, Troy King, who of course is running for Martha Roby's old seat in the House of Representatives to represent Alabama's 2nd District, he actually came out with a brand new campaign ad. And so I'm just going to let you watch it with no commentary from me. Make your own decision on how you feel about it, and then I'm going to come back and provide some commentary. So I want you to see it without really any introduction or context. So here it is.
There are some people who just don't like me.
Like the liberals who want to take our guns. They don't like you because you passed the Stand Your Ground law.
That's true.
The abortion people don't like you because you stood up for unborn babies.
That's true, too. I'm Troy King, and I approve this message, especially since liberals in Alabama haven't ever liked me.
It's okay, honey. The liberals in Washington are not going to like you either.
Thanks, Mom.
All right, so there's a reason that I wanted you to see that with absolutely no context whatsoever. There's a reason that I wanted you to look at it in the vacuum of... Now, if you already know who Troy King is or have spent any time studying him, then you obviously do have certain feelings about him before you ever go into that ad. But just looking at the ad itself, it's really not a bad ad. Especially in the state of Alabama, where we have a tendency to, and I think it's a good tendency, to respect our elders, to hold really strong family values. Troy King, appearing with an elderly member of his family, his mother, it humanizes him to a great degree for somebody that has had a lot of bad press in his career, and I would argue that it's deserved, but nonetheless, it humanizes him to a great degree, and it's going to play very well with the very pro-family, pro-elderly voter, and let's be honest, a very large constituency, a very large portion of Alabama's voter base are elderly people. Elderly people vote. I mean, that's even true on the national scale, but it's especially true in Alabama. Even on the national scale, you're seeing that Joe Biden, even though he's been fading, one of the reasons he's been able to stay alive as long as he has is because he has a pretty big market share of the senior vote. And despite the fact that Bernie supporters are very enthusiastic and very young and very willing to volunteer, that hasn't been able to break through because he doesn't have as much draw with older voters. And so what Troy King is doing here, from a purely political standpoint, if you don't know anything about his policies, don't know anything about who the guy is, it's very smart, and especially when the only two issues he actually addresses, now he addresses them incredibly vaguely, but the only two articles that he addresses are being pro-gun and against abortion. Now, if you could not ask for better issues to bring to the forefront of your campaign if you hold the correct stance on them in the state of Alabama. People are going to turn out in droves if they believe that their gun rights are in danger or they can do something to drive abortion out or make it more difficult. I mean, for goodness sake, we're the only state that actually has outlawed abortion. Now, of course, they're still going on because of a hold on the federal level, but the point is, this is a state that is incredibly pro-life and incredibly pro-gun. So the ad plays well. Here's the problem. The ad does play well in a vacuum if you have no idea who Troy King is. And I think that that's a thing that Troy King is actually hoping for and counting on. He's hoping that he has some name familiarity, more so than name recognition, because name recognition is, okay, I look at your name, I know who you are. Name familiarity, which is a similar thing, is like, I think I kind of remember that that guy held office at some point, so I'm going to vote for him. That's Troy King's best bet right now. That there are a lot of people that remember that Troy King is a politician in Alabama that may have done something, and because I have some kind of sense of familiarity with his name, I'm going to put my check next to his name. And he's really hoping that that's a large portion of Alabama's voters, ones that know that but don't really know anything about the man. So that's one of the draws of this ad. It seems to me that the reason that he did a political ad with his mom is because A, it's smart, but B, it's probably because it's the only person that was willing to do an ad with Troy King at this point in his career. I mean, it's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. If you know anything about Troy King, the guy is openly anti-free speech. He tried to go after, for example, Del Jackson and our sister station in Huntsville, tried to get the guy sued and tried to scare him into not saying negative things about him on the airwaves. The guy is one of the slimiest politicians in Alabama's history. You know, when we had all the ethics reform in 2010, that was largely a result of, and those laws were largely written off of crap that Troy King did. that was the case study. A lot of the things that Troy King did, taking bribes, taking from people like Alabama Power, people that are very influential in the state of Alabama, and turning the other way, and not to mention being in the pocket of the gambling cartels, all that stuff was legal at the time and has since been made illegal specifically because Troy King did them. Troy King's like the guy that first knocked off a liquor store before anybody ever thought to do that, and it wasn't illegal at the time, but that's only because nobody had ever thought that someone might actually knock off a liquor store. Once it happened, they were like, oh, this definitely needs to be illegal. And so that's who Troy King is. And it seems as though his mom is the only person even willing to do an ad with him, and the only person of influence in his life, and that's the reason that he would have her as opposed to somebody else endorsing him, because anybody that has been following politics in Alabama for more than about 10 seconds realizes that Troy King is the biggest snake in the grass that we have. So, that being said, the really funny thing about this ad is that he pretends as though the reason that people do not like him is because they're liberals. So what he's basically trying to do is, yeah, I know that a lot of you have some basic vague idea that I'm unpopular and that a lot of people don't like me. Well, here's the thing, they're liberals. The people that don't like me, they only don't like me because I'm just so conservative and they're so liberal, and that's the reason that they don't like me. They don't like me because I'm pro-life and pro-gun. No, there's an awful lot of people like me, a card-carrying member of the NRA, and a person that believes that the right to life is central to literally every other right you can possess, and that I give no legway to abortion whatsoever, not even in the extreme cases that we would talk about. And I'm still very much anti-Troy King. But that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to drum up this imagery of in people's heads that, well, if you hear that there's a person that doesn't like me, it's because they're really just liberal. It's just absurd on so many levels. People don't like him because he was a slimeball in office. People don't like him because of the incredibly seedy, underhanded things that he did when he was an attorney general. When he was the guy that was in charge of enforcing Alabama's laws, he was taking kickbacks from the people that he wasn't enforcing the law on. That's who Troy King is. And that's the reason that people in Alabama don't like him. And I hate this tribalist game of, well, if you're not with me, it's because you're one of them. Look, when it comes to politics, there's all kinds of reasons a person cannot be with you. Some of them legitimate, some of them not. Some of them because there's an honest difference, some of them because they genuinely don't like you. But trying to cast every single person that doesn't like you as one of them, one of the other tribe, somebody that can't be trusted, it's just absurd. So, to give an example, just something that happened recently, there are a lot of Republicans now that don't like Mitt Romney. And it's understandable why they don't like Mitt Romney, considering the way that he voted on the Trump impeachment, whether or not to convict the president, remove him from office or not. But regardless of how you feel about that, take that out. I'm just using this as an example. What if Mitt Romney came out with an ad saying, you know, there's a lot of people that don't like me. They don't like me because I'm too pro-life and too pro-gun. So what he's doing is he's casting all the people that like Trump and think that the evidence that was brought up against him is bogus. He's saying, no, they're all just really liberals. No, actually, a lot of the people that don't like Mitt Romney because of that are very conservative. Disliking a person doesn't automatically put you in the enemy camp. And I hate this tribalist garbage where the second that there's something that we don't agree with about somebody, oh, the only reason we don't like them is because we're one of the others. We're one of the people that are opposed to them. There's all kinds of people that I'm opposed to. For example, I'll give you an example ideologically. Take even the personalities out of it. As a Christian, I'm very much for there being a lot more regulation on pornography. It's too easy for little kids to get to. I did two shows last week where the vast majority of the show was dedicated to this problem that we're having in our society where there are too many people, especially people that are underage, having access to pornography. I'm very against that. But there could also be somebody that's kind of a Lena Dunham type, that's a very pro-feminist, pro-woman type, that's very against pornography too. Now, her rationale may be completely different from mine. She might be an atheist or a Wiccan or whatever else. doesn't believe that the sexual acts going on in the pornography or the people watching the pornography are immoral. They just don't like the fact that it degrades women and treats them like sexual objects, which, you know, is something that I agree with. But the point is, the rationale can be completely different and you still arrive at the same place. There are people, for example, that are white nationalists that just want there to be closed borders and nobody to ever come into the country. There are also people that are just economically looking at the numbers and saying, we should probably put a pause on immigration just for a little bit, if nothing else, so that we can, you know, absorb the people that are already here, get ourselves economically in a better status, and then open the borders back up again for people to come in through a legal process so that the system can absorb the cost of that. But they both want the border to close, one temporarily, maybe one permanently, because they want a holy white nation or, you know, whatever else. But the point is, they arrive at the same place, getting there through very different means. This is the issue with the Troy King argument that everybody that disagrees with them, they're only doing that because they're liberal. Now, there's an awful lot of people that disagree with them for lots of different reasons, and it has nothing to do with their political reason. Anybody, Democrat or Republican, that wants a decent person in office that is not going to take advantage and profit off of his office would be a person that if they know Troy King, they would be against him. Has nothing to do with their political leanings. And another thing that is odd about this, I don't know philosophically how pro-gun and pro-life Troy King is. As an attorney general, it's hard to gauge that in a lot of ways. I have no reason to believe that he is somebody that is in favor of gun control or in favor of abortion. But here's the thing. That's not what I criticize Troy King on, and to my knowledge, never have. But if you're running in a Republican primary, being pro-gun and anti-abortion, that's a pretty low bar to clear. I said the exact same thing about Martha Roby. One of the things that in her last election, this is the seat that Troy King is running for now, Martha Roby, who had an F score from all of the conservative sites, Conservative Review, Freedom Works, the Heritage Foundation, all of those that gave her a rating on how conservative her voting record was, they all gave her an F. But what did she always talk about when it came to elections? Well, I have an A rating from the NRA and an A rating from the National Right to Life. Which she did, it's just, that's the bare minimum. You're bragging about doing the absolute bare minimum. I mean, it would be almost like if you were trying to ask a girl out, it's like, hey, I'm not an axe murderer. Okay, well, you know, that's a point in your favor. Not really something that's going to convince me that you're the kind of guy that I need to go out with. And it's the same thing with this political example. I'm glad that Troy King is against abortion. I'm glad Troy King is in favor of the Second Amendment. But literally every other candidate he is running against, you could say exactly the same thing for. That is not an argument for me to pick you as the candidate, especially when there's all this other baggage that you're refusing to talk about. So ultimately, Mr. King is kind of like the Mr. Haney of this race. You remember Mr. Haney? I don't know how many of you. I know I have a younger audience, so maybe some of you won't get this, but if you've ever watched Green Acres, you remember Mr. Haney? He would always come around, Mr. Douglas, do you need, you know, whatever it was that he needed? And of course, Mr. Douglas would always say he didn't need it, and then he wound up buying it anyway. And then the second he bought it, it turns out that whatever thing it is that he bought doesn't work. That's what Troy King is trying to do here. He's trying to pull a bait and switch. He's trying to come up, oh, I'm a conservative, and you need to vote for me because I'm conservative. And then the second you buy into it, you'll find out, no, this thing doesn't do anything that it asked me to. Like the time that Mr. Haney came in and Mr. Douglas had overslept, and he's like, well, it seems to me you need a rooster. And so he sells him a rooster, and then the rooster won't crow unless he also buys the hen that goes with the rooster. Now, from an animal science standpoint, that's ridiculous, but the point is, that's how Mr. Haney got him. He sold him something that he knew going into the deal wouldn't work. And he was hoodwinking him. He was taking him in. And that's exactly what Troy King is trying to do with the voters of the state of Alabama. Hopefully, the people of the state of Alabama will not get fooled again. They've already rejected him for the most recent election that he ran in. Hopefully, they don't get fooled this time either. We'll go to a quick break and we'll be back in just a minute on Tactics.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
And welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us now. There is an update on some world news that we need to go into because there was some new information that was shared this morning about the coronavirus, and there was a really great article. Where was it? I want to say it was the New York Times, but I know it's weird for me to compliment the New York Times, but they were talking about why actually the coronavirus will actually be less effective in the United States than it is in China, which is a good thing. Apparently, part of the reason for this is because the coronavirus is primarily a respiratory infection. And so because of that, it affects your breathing, it affects your lungs, that kind of thing. And not to say that it wouldn't be serious if it caught on here in the United States, and not to say that we shouldn't still be doing everything that we can to combat it, but at least in the United States, they predict it won't be as potent as it is in China or maybe in Europe, and that's because since it does primarily affect the respiratory system, smokers are at a very high risk, and the reason that it is spreading so quickly, one of the reasons, there are also other reasons, but one of the reasons it's more deadly in China is because a very large portion of the Chinese population smokes, and a lot of them have been smoking since like 14 years old. And so as you can imagine, there's an awful lot of people that have a lot of serious lung damage already when they contract the coronavirus, and that makes it much harder for them because their lungs weren't all that strong to begin with, and because of that, it really does affect them to the point that they, you know, their respiratory system could shut down. And so the good news is, at least even though we obviously wish that nobody would have to deal with this, in America, there's so much fewer people that smoke or have smoked for a really long time that even though the coronavirus would still definitely do some damage, it wouldn't be nearly as deadly here as it is in China. Now, that being said, for those of you who may remember, I'm a cancer patient, and the specific kind of chemo, I took 3 chemo drugs. One of them is especially harsh on the lungs. And while I was taking chemotherapy, I also had 4 PE blood clots in each of my lungs. So, in a completely unrelated note, if anyone needs me, I'm going to be in my bunker, and I will see y'all in 2021. Thanks, everybody. Stay the course, friends. No, I'm kidding. But, I don't know. It is something that worries me. And it does kind of suck, because as horrible as it is that anybody would contract this virus and be weak to it because of a lifetime of smoking, I didn't do that, and I still might be really susceptible to it, so let's pray that there's not a big coronavirus in Alabama, because, of course, that would be horrible, and we want to keep it as contained as possible. But even, you know, from a personal standpoint, I'm really concerned about it because my lungs probably have some lasting damage from the chemotherapy I was taking. So let's hope that does not become a complication for me at any time in the future. That being said, I do think it's time that we go ahead and go to our daily dose of stupid.
That was stupid.
I know it was stupid.
Really stupid.
Hey, I just said it was stupid.
Today's daily dose of stupid should come as no surprise. It is coming out of the state of Virginia. So for those of you who don't know, while we were away for the weekend, the Virginia Senate actually did pass the 3 gun control measures that they had been talking about. It was the one that spurred the whole big protest that happened on Martin Luther King Day weekend, the one that everybody's been buzzing about. These are the 3 measures, and if you want a breakdown of everything that was going on in that, go back to, I think it was either the Tuesday or Wednesday after Martin Luther King Day, where we break down all of the different aspects of this bill. I'm not going to do it because I've already done it once on the show. So if you're interested what all that passage means, that's where you need to go. I'll have to look up the episode at some point, but it's on this channel. There are other YouTubers that have taken care of this issue and talk about some of the different things that it does. So I give my breakdown there. I'm not going to get into the weeds of what exactly this bill does, but it's an incredibly draconian, I mean, overbearing, nanny state kind of law that is turns Virginia into basically as gun restrictive as the state of New York or California. So it's a major shift from what was typically considered a more gun-friendly state to a very, very restrictive state when it comes to guns. And one of the things that I think bothers me so much about this and bothers a lot of the patriots there in Virginia that just want to exercise their Second Amendment rights and are obviously very upset about this because of that and because this these gun control measures make it much, much harder to do that. I do want you to remember that the people that are passing this in Virginia, and since this is probably going to be signed by Governor Ralph Northam, it is going to be fascinating to see how the rest of the state reacts, considering they have declared, the vast majority of the counties in Virginia have declared themselves a sanctuary county for the Second Amendment. So that'll be really fascinating to see how that is handled, and we, of course, are going to keep an eye on that. But one of the things that irks a lot of people is that these are largely decisions that are not going to make a difference, that do not make sense. And if you know even the very bare bones basics like me about firearms, you know that the people that are making these decisions are completely clueless about them. And they are making decisions, very important decisions, that affect you, that affect your ability to defend yourself and to defend your family, despite knowing absolutely nothing about the subject matter. And just like you wouldn't want somebody that knows nothing about the subject matter making decisions on things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, that sort of thing, for the same reason you wouldn't want somebody that knows nothing about the subject matter deciding whether or not you can or cannot exercise your religion or your freedom of speech or, for example, going through your personal items with the Fourth Amendment, that kind of thing that protects you from unreasonable searches and seizures. You wouldn't want somebody doing that when it comes to the Second Amendment, especially when the things that they're talking about don't make any difference. And to kind of illustrate this, there was a video that was put out by the NRA, and this is they call them something different in Virginia, Delegate Mark Levine, no relation to Mark Levin, who appears on News Radio 1440, Mark Levine, and he's asked a very simple question. A question that anybody that is integral to a bill like this or legislation like this, you would think that they would be able to, you know, answer that question, because one of the pieces of legislation bans assault weapons. And all the person in the audience ask him, and you'll hear him ask the question, what's an assault weapon? And I think you'll enjoy his response.
Question from the audience. Please define assault weapon.
Hunting weapons, weapons used for self-defense, weapons used for sport shooting, from weapons that are the preferred weapons for mass shooters. What the bill does is it distinguishes basically the difference between guns that go like this. These are rifles. You use them to shoot an animal, and you can shoot very precisely. Mass shooters don't like things that go like this. So the mass shooters use guns that go like this. All right? Pistol grips, things like that. And guns that go like this are wildly inaccurate. That's why hunters don't like them. That's what these guns do. That's why they're so useful in the military. You want to mow down an approaching army. They're not useful in hunting. Shotguns, very powerful. You shoot a shotgun, and it shoots some 40 pellets out, and if someone's coming to approach you, and they face the end of a shotgun, they're in big trouble. In terms of the differences between the guns, the heart of the difference is how you hold the gun. Basically, it's a semi-automatic, meaning that you can shoot with each finger, not like a bolt action where you have to kick out the cartridges. It's none of those. It has to be semi-automatic. And it must contain one of these weapons of war type features. Things like a pistol grip, things like a flash suppressor, too, which basically conceals where the flash is coming from. Things like a silencer that was used in Virginia Beach to basically not show what the gunshots sound like. Grab that red hot magazine. They take 10 mags. They take their template magazine. They can shoot 10. Then they have to take 1 to 2 seconds to change the magazine. If it's 100 bullets, they might have to take 10 to 20 seconds. I don't know about you, I spend more of that time in the traffic line. The fact that gun owners may have to take 10 or 20 seconds more, so our bill allows people to keep their weapons, including their AR-15s and the like. They can keep their weapons, but we've asked them to do what people have done with machine guns when they were banned in 1934, to basically get a permit so we know where they are, so they aren't used by criminals.
So that's Virginia Delegate Mark Levine. I want you to keep in mind, this guy is not a flunky. He's not some random Democrat that they pulled out of the Virginia delegation that was going to be voting on it to speak about this. The reason he was speaking at this event is because he is the sponsor of the bill. This is the guy that drafted the legislation that brought it before the House in Virginia. He is the sponsor of House Bill 78. And he cannot define assault weapon despite the fact that he's the one that wants to ban them. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. It would be like asking my opinion on something that dealt with nuclear physics, and I can't even define the thing that I want to get rid of, and I say, well, it doesn't matter. I still think that we should pass this. And I'm the one leading the charge. No, it's too dangerous. We shouldn't. I'm not saying that the average person should know everything about this. I'm saying, though, that if you are going to be somebody that is making laws that affects this, you need to have at least some basic level of expertise when it comes to these things. And he proves throughout this entire video, he knows absolutely nothing about guns. I mean, nothing. I was astounded by the fact, you would think by sheer probability, he would occasionally get something right. The only thing where he kind of came within the realm of being correct is where he talked about how powerful shotguns are, which they are. And it's also very odd that despite the fact that they're the ones that are by far more deadly, and he seems to understand that that is the case, that he's not talking about banning shotguns, which is strange considering he's talking about how deadly they are, and yet that's not the one he wants to ban. He wants to ban rifles. But anyway, and pistols, by the way, because this legislation has to do with that as well. So let's real quick go through point by point several of the different things, and I'm not going to go into everything because I've covered most of this ground before, but point by point, I'm going to go through just a handful of things that he got completely wrong. First of all, there is a myth that has been going around and has been for a very long time that AR-15s are the preferred weapons of mass shooters, and you heard him in that clip right there. He was trying to perpetuate this myth as well, saying, you know, we're trying to get rid of specifically the guns that mass shooters like. Mass shooters don't like rifles that go like this. They like pistol grips. All right, well, here is a graphic, and the source here is the FBI crime statistics. This shows a breakdown by weapon of all of the different weapons that are used in active shooting events between the years 2000 and 2015. Now, as you can see, when you talk about a weapon that is preferred by mass shooters, the overwhelming majority, over 56%, handguns, pistols. And then you have 27% for rifle, 14% for shotgun, and then 3% that they're not sure. But now I want you to consider this as well, that 27% for rifles, that's all rifles. That's not rifles specifically with pistol grips. That's not specifically AR-15s. That's not semi-automatic rifles. It's just rifles. That includes all of them. Which means if even 1% of those rifles happen to be non-pistol grip, that it's even less than what that chart shows. Now, why would the FBI not record whether or not they're pistol grip rifles or semi-automatic rifles, or just, you know, a bolt-action rifle or a lever-action rifle or something that you would think of that would, you know, it's older, it's something that you have to actually, it's double action for you to be able to fire off a shot, because it doesn't matter to the FBI. They're not tracking it that specifically because it bears no significance in trying to stop mass shootings, and the FBI knows that. There isn't a discernible pattern that would lead them to believe that looking at that and having that data would make them somehow more efficient at stopping mass shootings, because there are people that use non-semi-automatic rifles in mass shootings. And like I said, pistols are by far the overwhelming weapon of choice when it comes to mass shootings anyway. So not only are rifles with pistol grip specifically not the choice of mass shooters, rifles as a whole aren't even the choice of mass shooters by a wide margin. And another thing where he said that it was just utterly stupid was that, oh, well, you see, when you're hunting, you want something that goes like this, which I've done this before. Second Amendment's not about hunting, so that's a non-argument. You can look at, there's nothing, no indication whatsoever that the founders were writing the Second Amendment. I mean, it's actually in the Second Amendment what they wrote it for. They actually give a qualification there. But hunting is not an issue in this at all. It's certainly a good thing that you can do with your gun, but it's not the reason we have a Second Amendment. It's a non-starter when it comes to an argument. But what he's saying is the reason that hunters like your standard grip, where your grip is sort of integrated with the butt of your, or the stock of your firearm, they want one where the grip is more like this, as opposed to a pistol grip that usually is added on underneath the firearm. He's saying that that makes it less accurate. So what I did was, because again, I don't have a lot of expertise on guns. I've just studied it a little bit, certainly more than this guy. But I went and looked at the most popular military sniper rifles. So these are specifically sniper rifles, the ones that are the most accurate, the ones that militaries around the world choose when they need to be the most precise. Because, of course, snipers aren't mowing down armies or anything. They're specifically taking out targets. So out of the top 10, these are all the rifles that militarytoday.com listed as their most popular sniper rifles. And let's see, we've got number 1, number 4, number 10, and an honorable mention. Oh, look at that, all with pistol grips. And remember that the number 1, the most popular rifle used in the American military, the Barrett M82, is a sniper rifle with a pistol grip. So the idea that that is somehow the pistol grip makes it less accurate or something, that's stupid. Anybody that's fired any of these guns or fired any gun with a pistol grip versus one that has the stock integrated with the grip will tell you that it doesn't make a significant difference when it comes to your accuracy. And here is the rest of the list from Military Today on the most popular sniper rifles. Now, you will notice here that there are a few that do not have pistol grips, or sorry, none of these actually have pistol grips, but every single one has a feature integrated into the stock that makes you hold it more like a pistol grip. So in other words, you have either a thumb hole or the stock is designed in such a way where you hold the grip more vertically than horizontally, which is what Representative Mark Levine was trying to say. He's like, well, you know, you can only be accurate if you're holding it up like this as opposed to down here like this. Well, no, each of those guns, even the ones that don't have pistol grips for snipers, they have something that more resembles that. And if you watch movies like American Sniper, for example, you'll notice that the weapon of choice for Chris Kyle had a similar function. His rifle actually had a thumb hole, and you held it upright like this. It's not a pistol grip because it's integrated with the stock, but it's a very similar method of holding it. The assertion that holding a gun a certain way makes it more deadly is just stupid. It is almost a purely cosmetic effect, and it certainly does not make a gun more effective at committing mass shootings. So they're grasping at straws, and he's talking about things he has no idea what he's delving into. And let's also remember, because he also said, again, I know that the hunting thing is a non-issue, but he said that pistol grips are no good for hunting, and that's why hunters don't like them. The most popular rifle, the most popular hunting rifle in America is an AR-15. The best-selling one. So apparently there are at least a few million hunters that do like pistol grips and do want to use them for hunting. Now, another thing that he got onto, and again, we're not going to go into great detail here, but how you hold the gun doesn't make it semi-automatic, because you'll notice that's another thing he tried to do with the grip, trying to justify why the grip makes it an assault weapon versus a non-assault weapon. Believe me, if you get hit from a gun that has a pistol grip and you get hit by a center fire round, it's the same caliber of a gun that doesn't have a pistol grip, you're not going to know the difference. It's going to hurt exactly the same amount. The bullet's going to travel at exactly the same speed. That slug is going to go just as deep in it. It makes no difference whatsoever in the functionality of the firearm itself. But how you hold it, because he said that's the difference. When you hold it down here, it's a semi-automatic. No, there are semi-automatics where you hold it a different way. There are also non-semi-automatics that have a pistol grip. Heck, there are even shotguns that have pistol grips. I've seen one myself. I've used one before. So the whole idea that a purely cosmetic, that would almost be like saying, well, it's not a race car until you paint a racing stripe on it. See, because that's the purpose of a racing stripe, is so you know that it's a race car. And once you paint the racing stripe on the car, well, then it's a race car. No, that has nothing to do with the engine or the functionality of the vehicle itself. I mean, you couldn't take somebody's VW Beetle, paint a racing stripe on it, and all of a sudden it can compete with the cars in NASCAR. That's not how this works. But that's essentially the argument that Mark Levine just made for it. Another thing, too, silencers do not make your gun silent. And I think my favorite quote in the entire video, which there were quite a few of them, was that the silencer showed what guns sound like. I don't think you can show what a gun sounds like. Sounds are audio, showing is a visual thing, so probably just a gaffe, but nonetheless, it was funny. Silencers typically take a gunshot from like 130, 140 decibels down to about 100, 110. That's not quiet. So if you're a football fan, you'll know that Jordan-Hare Stadium, when it gets really rowdy and really loud, it can get up to about 130-ish, 140 decibels. So even at the absolute loudest that Jordan-Hare can get, it gets pretty close to what a gunfire would sound like. And that takes it down to 110, which is still like listening to a hard heavy metal rock inside your headphones at full blast. It's still super loud. Putting a silencer on a gun doesn't do what you see in the James Bond movies, where it's like a pea shooter, where you just hold up the pistol and fire it and it goes, pfft. No, that's not how silencers work. Anybody within the immediate area can still very clearly hear a gun just because it has a silencer. That's why most people that actually do know what they're talking about when it comes to guns don't call them silencers, they call them suppressors. Ironically, silencer was a marketing ploy that they used when they were first invented right around the Teddy Roosevelt era. They called them silencers because they wanted to market them as, oh, this makes your gun super quiet. But no device in the world can do that. So they suppress the sound, they don't silence the gun. So obviously he has no knowledge on that either. Another thing that was pretty funny is like, well, the magazines that get red hot, no, magazines don't get hot. All of the action is happening further up the gun. Your magazine does not get hot when you fire a firearm. The barrel gets hot. The center part, the action of the gun, gets hot. Your magazine doesn't get hot. And then another thing that's really funny is that he doesn't even realize, even with his extreme lack of knowledge on the subject matter, that even by his own logic, he's still contradicting himself. Because one of the points that he tries to make is, we're not banning guns. They can keep their guns. They can keep their AR-15s. All we're asking them to do is what happened back in the 1930s when we banned machine guns and basically tell them that they have to get a permit for that. So you're telling us you don't want to ban guns. You just want to make it like machine guns, which we banned. You see, without knowing it, he kind of bleeds his hand there. That's the ultimate long-term goal for Democrats. They want guns to be banned. They want guns to be just like machine guns, where you have to be literally a millionaire just to be able to afford the permits and to be able to have them and use them as sport shooting or as some kind of hobby instrument. That's what they really want, because you can technically legally own a machine gun in the United States of America it's just pretty much impossible unless you're a millionaire because of how expensive the papers are to get them done, how expensive it is to actually register yourself, and then how expensive it is to buy the guns because they're incredibly expensive because nobody's making them anymore, so there's a short supply and a high demand. Well, that's actually what they want for all firearms. And he basically, without knowing it, just admitted to it there on camera. I don't want to ban guns. I just don't want to. I just want to do to them what we did to machine guns back in the day. We just want to make semi-automatic firearms, like fully automatic firearms, were in the 1930s. Well, so you're saying you want to ban guns. That's what you're telling me, if that's the case. And the thing is, the only way to make that work would be to do exactly what happened with machine guns, and that is to start a registry. So we're not coming for your guns, but we're totally coming for your guns, and we're going to need you to sign a permit so we know where those guns are. That only works if there is a registry. And registry is always the first step to full-on gun confiscation. That's what happens every time. And not to mention the fact that if a gun registry were put in place, it would completely defeat the purpose of the Second Amendment, which is to defend the American people and their rights against a tyrannical government. Well, if the government knows where all the guns are and what their functionality is, all they have to do is go round them up before they start being tyrannical. That's why a gun registry completely breaks the purpose of the Second Amendment. It would be the same thing if we decided that we had to license journalists and license news companies before we allowed them to just say anything they wanted to. Well, that would defeat the purpose of free speech. It's free speech as long as we get to decide who's speaking and what they say. Well, what you're saying isn't free speech then. And that's exactly the same thing that's going on here. What they're talking about is not being able to own, to keep and bear your firearms. And I think the main issue with all of this is that it gets frustrating when you have people that obviously have absolutely no idea what they're talking about, and they're the ones that are putting all of this together. They're the ones that are dictating to us, who know a lot more about this stuff, what we're allowed to do and not allowed to do. That gets old real quick. Let's go to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on Tactics.
Chaplain's Report today is a story right out of the book of Genesis, and it's one that we're probably all at least somewhat familiar with, but I want to take a different look at a different side of that story, because especially in the later parts of Genesis, and this isn't something that's done as an error or a mistake, it's just the way that the book kind of goes, is that everything tends to focus on Joseph, and I want to focus on another kind of side character for the duration of this particular chaplain's report. But just so you know what's going on, the Joseph story, we all know that he was given a coat of many colors, and his brothers grew jealous, took his coat of many colors, threw him into a pit, and then eventually drew him out just to be sold off as a slave into Egypt. And what they did was they told their father that his favorite son, Joseph, had been killed. And so this all goes on. They all keep the secret. Jacob, their father, doesn't know about this. And Joseph goes through all kinds of stuff in Egypt, but eventually becomes the number two guy in the entire kingdom. Egypt is flourishing partly because of Joseph. And everybody else is going through this severe famine. So what happens is Joseph's family goes to Egypt to buy grain. They need food because they're struggling through the famine as well. And through sheer happenstance, when they come, they run into Joseph. And Joseph recognizes them, but they don't know who Joseph is because he's now dressed as an Egyptian. He doesn't look like himself anymore. And so they don't recognize him. So Joseph is playing this back and forth with them, and they bring his younger brother, Benjamin. And what he does is he plants a silver cup in Benjamin's satchel, and then he has his men go out and retrieve it and accuses his brothers of theft. Now, he's the one that put the cup there, and the whole purpose was to get the guards to bring his brothers back to him. So this is the context that they find themselves in. Here's Joseph, and Joseph at this point is holding all the cards. He knows what all is going on here. He's the one that set this whole thing up. None of the brothers understand that or know that. And all the other brothers know is that somehow this very expensive silver cup wound up in Benjamin's bag. And so this is the part of the story that I really want to focus on, where the brothers are not sure how they're going to get out of this mess. All they know is that their father, who has already lost one son, is now about to lose his other favorite son, his little brother. And so this particular passage is really where we're going to start. This comes from Genesis chapter 44, verses 31 through 34. And it reads, "When he," talking about his father here, this is Judah speaking, "when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surely that for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame for my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad, a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to the father if the lad is not with me? For fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father." Now, I want you to try to put yourself in Judah's shoes, and I think that'll be a little bit easier when you understand the kind of person that Judah has been up to this point. Judah is a very flawed individual. His brothers look up to him. He's kind of seen as, oddly enough, somewhat of a leader amongst his brothers, despite the fact that he's not the oldest. Reuben is the oldest. But he's not the most responsible man. After two of his sons died while they were married to Tamar, he kind of abstained from his responsibility to make sure that Tamar had somebody to take care of her and just kind of abandoned her, honestly. And so he had a bad habit of doing this, and he also was not very responsible with Joseph. You know, when they threw Joseph in the pit, it was Reuben that said, "No, let's not kill him." Because everybody else wanted to kill him, including Judah. They wanted to murder their own brother out of jealousy. And if it hadn't been for Reuben, they probably would have. And so Judah has not been the best big brother, to say the least. And he's not always done exactly the right thing either. And here we see Judah willing to sell himself into slavery for a crime that, as far as he knows, was committed by somebody else. You see, I think we see a lot of character growth in Judah, going from somebody that was willing to kill his own little brother out of petty jealousy to somebody that is willing to give his own life to protect his brother and to make sure that his brother and father could be with each other once again. It really does show how life can change people. How Judah, who up until this point has lived not a model life, to say the least, is willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. Now, the older translations will say give life to. It's probably a better translation to say that he was going to be an indentured servant to Joseph that entire time because of the Hebrew word that's used there. But either way, Judah is willing to give up his life to become a slave to Joseph, who he doesn't know is Joseph, just to protect his family. That takes an amazing amount of courage. And we see how Judah has come a very long way in the span of his life. And maybe part of the reason that he did is because he recognized that he made some pretty significant mistakes in the past. And now it's time for him to do the right thing. And another thing that has always astounded me about biblical study is how much of the Bible foreshadows. And I think you can't find a better example of that anywhere in the scripture than right here. Here we have an older brother that is willing to give up his life to make up for the crime that was committed by his younger brother. Now, Benjamin was innocent, but he doesn't know that. For all he knew, Benjamin really did steal the cup. Didn't matter to Judah. He was willing to become Joseph's slave to make that right, regardless. And what did he sacrifice himself for? Well, in part to protect Benjamin, sure. But so that Benjamin, the son that, at least in Judah's eyes, has committed a crime, can be restored to a relationship with their father. I mean, that's as good an analogy for what happens to Christ later in the Bible as any you'll ever find. Where we have our older brother, Jesus, and that's very well established, especially in the book of Hebrews, that Jesus Christ is the firstborn of the dead. He is our older brother, gave up his life so that we could find atonement for our sins, the sins that were separating us from our heavenly Father. You see, the goal of Jesus' mission was reconciliation of his father and his younger siblings. Ultimately, when you boil it right down, that's what Jesus came to earth to do. To make sure that his father could be with his children. And he was the only one that could do that. And here in the story of Judah, we see exactly the same thing taking place. His love for his father and his love for his little brother outweighs his love for himself. And ultimately, that's the reason Jesus is able to make the sacrifice that he does. Because he loves his father so much and he loves all of us so much that he wants us to be able to be together again. That is an amazing summary of the gospel of Jesus Christ, contained as early as the book of Genesis. This was always part of God's plan. God always knew that. And I think that that's why he puts little stories like this in the scripture, to prepare the way and to prepare the world for the story of a redeeming Savior. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.